I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. I'm by no means scientifically interested, nor have the inclination to read a book on biology. However, a new book that's hit my desk is one I've thoroughly enjoyed reading. It's called The Ptarmigan's Dilemma, an exploration into how life organizes and supports itself. It's not a textbook at all and is thoroughly engaging and highly readable to the layman. Its authors, John Theberge and Mary Theberge, join me now. They've drawn on breakthrough research in evolution and genetics, as well as their many years in the field and lab as wildlife biologists, to look at how evolution works. It's a thoughtful book on how we and the species around us got here, as well as it ponders as to where we're all heading. John Theberge is a retired professor in the Faculty of Environmental Studies at the University of Waterloo. Mary Theberge is a wildlife illustrator and wolf researcher. They join me from here in Vancouver. The book is published by McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, John and Mary Theberge. Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. Theberge.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. This idea, Mary, that life adapts and organizes itself, is that revolutionary?
No, it's not revolutionary. My goodness, Darwin had thought of it, his grandfather had, actually even Aristotle had, and they could see natural selection progressing, evolution progressing. It's sequential change. Natural selection drives successful adaptations, and it shapes the set of biotic processes that are going to be enduring. If it fails to operate and doesn't make a successful species, then that species isn't going to exist, whether it's an ecosystem or whether it's a mouse.
So what's
I can add to that, while the evidence for evolution and the mechanism, the key mechanism, natural selection, has been known for a long time, there's new advances coming all the time in how evolution works. It's just amazing the scientific discovery in recent years that makes it clear that natural selection is even more powerful than we knew, that basic processes like capturing energy on Earth, recently a new pigment has been found in the millions of bacteria, viruses that exist in the oceans that may be sort of equivalent to photosynthesis, chlorophyll's contribution to photosynthesis that energizes life. So there's new discoveries that flesh things out being made all the time.
So how much of it is man-made, say?
The proteodopsins aren't man-made. They're there. They're major sources of energy capture that the Earth has. It's only been in the last few years that we've been able to find that these organisms exist.
But in terms of say, what man has done to the environment, has that had an impact, say, on all this?
Oh, sure. You could fairly say that the biosphere is under assault because of humans. Besides climate change, we're perpetrating the what's thought of as the sixth major extinction event on Earth. There have been five previous ones. Every time, life has bounced back. And that's the good news, I suppose, in this sixth extinction event, the processes that keep life going will survive. A lot of the species won't, and who knows whether humans will or not. But the good news is that the biota of the world is tremendously resilient and quite likely will bounce back from whatever we do about it. That's not a reason to be complacent about environmental things. Bounce back takes, a million years or more, so we're liable to leave our immediate descendants impoverished world.
And in terms of climate change, one reviewer of the book made mention that you don't talk about opposing views to that. So I guess you both come from the position that it is here. It is.
Well, sure, it is. And on the mountain we live in, in the Okanagan, we see changes in the distribution of birds and some animals moving up the mountainside as there's warmer temperatures. There's all sorts of evidence that it's happening.
Well, the thing is, Earth's undergone many, many changes. A global ice cooling would affect us a lot more than heating would. The only problem is, if we get a lot of these ice caps melting now, it is going to impact species, and as John has said, invariably will be impoverished, by not having those species. But at the same time, we're going to have 150 million people that are going to be displaced. People here in Vancouver are going to be easily displaced as water levels go higher and higher. Think of all the various areas throughout the world, England, Holland, Denmark, that are really going to be impacted by rising water levels.
Mary, you write in the book about a time that you spent near the Grand Canyon.
Yes.
Well, what did that mean to you?
Well, it was very humbling, the time at the Grand Canyon, because as we looked down at the various layers within the Grand Canyon, you could see the tiny little organisms that had been here before we were there. And questions arose to us, and they really begged for an explanation as to how all-embracing life is. If we need life, we need it to breathe, we need it to function for us, things that we impact this area so dramatically. It's like a surgeon operating on a heart. We basically will ruin this whole circulatory system of the earth if we impact all of these systems. The Grand Canyon, to me it was a creation, not a creation that any god or deity developed, but it was a creation over time, seas and erosion and mountain building, all of this has impacted that particular area.
And you call it a benchmark in how you came to the thinking that you come to now, right?
Right.
And for John, it was when you were at Guelph, you were listening to a lecture. What was the lecture?
Yes, it was a lecture about evolution and trying to put evolution and what you might call religion or speculation or whatever you might, the ideas beyond science into some perspective. And the lecture, it was a man named Dr. Hugh Dale. He was a botanist, and he described the science as a staircase, and each discovery is another step along the way, and it goes up and up and up. But scientists, perhaps more than most people, realize that there is a plateau at the top. There's a landing. There's a forefront of knowledge, and scientific research continues to try to push that forefront along so we understand more. But most scientists are very aware that there's more beyond that we can't reach. We can't probably reach it even with the methods of science. We peck away at that forefront, but there's mysteries that go beyond what we'll ever probably be able to discover.
So what is the ptarmigan's dilemma?
Well, the ptarmigan are members of the grouse family, and they live year-round in the Arctic, and they're capable of withstanding some of the coldest conditions on Earth. And they survive then on one of the margins of what we can think of as life's habitable zone. They face a dilemma of how to stay in that zone. So we sort of symbolize them as an example of that all species face of staying within the acceptable limits of physical tolerance. The habitable zone is a term that astronomers use to define places in the universe where life may exist, and it's basically defined by water, temperatures and pressures where water can be a liquid, because water is really sort of a biomolecule. It's essential for life. For any planet to stay within the habitable zone is a long shot, considering planetary wobble and changes in atmosphere, but ours has done so for 3.5 billion years or so. A couple of times we almost fell out. Five times ice and snow blanketed the entire Earth, colloquially called periods of snowball Earth, or snowball pole to pole. And yet, even through that, life has persisted. So we have all this richness around us today, and it attests to a tremendous adaptability.
And the birds itself, they have a problem in terms of, I'm trying to remember now what it was in the book.
Well, they're caught in a dilemma between the hens are between letting their chicks freeze and having them starve. They're given short periods where they can go out and forage, and then the hen broods them. And on the tundra, we studied them in Alaska. They have short little periods out of a few minutes to forage, and maybe snowing and fierce winds blowing, and then they're brooded again. So the ptarmigan has a dilemma to which way to keep the birds alive in this dilemma. But I won't tell you the exact details of what we found in our research. We'll leave that to the reader to discover.
Yeah, people.
The young are different than robins and some of the birds in the nest, since they need their parents to come and feed them, whereas ptarmigan are born, they're precocious. They're able to go and feed themselves from the moment that they're born.
And then the other thing, you had raised them, had you, in the course of your research?
Yes, we did. We studied them in the field, and we also took eggs into an aviary at the University of Alaska. We wanted to keep them under constant conditions. And when we presented, we were studying the role of aggression in limiting population numbers. Most of our research has been on factors that limit population numbers. So we presented these little chicks with a mirror. They could look at themselves within an hour of first being hatched. And we found that they were genetically different levels of aggression shown in these little chicks. Immediately, some would attack the mirror when they saw this image of themselves. Others would run away to the other side of the pen. And whatever behavior they showed in that first hour of life, that was it for them. They were genetically programmed. They'd be showing the same behavior a year later on the breeding grounds. It showed an inherited level of aggression. So aggression in an animal is sort of a two-part thing. It's partly environmental. There has to be sort of triggers for it in the environment, but it's also there's an inherent component to it as well.
And I found the part about them growing gallbladders interesting.
That's right. And this is where we have something called epigenetics came into play. The environment can call up an expression of hidden genes that are already there. I imagine birds had gallbladders, and they had been latent. The genes for them had been latent and hadn't expressed themselves. But we were feeding the birds a high diet in fat. We had chopped up eggs for them along with lettuce, and they weren't used to handling a high-fat diet, and they developed gallbladders.
So most members of the grouse family don't have gallbladders, mainly because, as Mary mentioned, their natural diet is very low in fat. But we fed them too much fat, and they developed one, which was surprising because most people would think of an organ like a gallbladder being a genetic entity. It wasn't a way, but they had it showed that they had the gene.
It was a hidden gene.
For gallbladder, but it wasn't being expressed. And so the environment essentially turned on that gene. And it's an example of this whole new field of biology and human medical research, which isn't just genetics, the presence or absence of genes, but the environment, whether they turn genes on or off. And we're just on the cusp of realizing how important that is, and I think we'll see years of medical research going into trying to understand this interplay between the environment and genes being turned on and off and then inherited in subsequent generations.
So all organisms possess this extensive bank of genes that normally aren't expressed, and then as environmental conditions change, they trigger that expression.
And the other thing, there was a chapter in the book, and I'm trying to remember now what it was about. In your study of these different species, you would learn about humans, and you could take your research from certain species and apply those to humans. But the danger in that is that not all species are created equal, and that science, when we read about it popularly in magazines and so on, we tend to think that what happens in a certain animal could be translated to a human, and that's something that we should avoid, right?
Well, in some cases, yes. In some cases, no. as a population ecologists, we're impressed that perhaps the most important sort of ecological principle applies to all animals, including humans, and that's that no species can expand indefinitely in a finite space. If you think of that reality, that there are mechanisms of population control that inevitably work, whether you're talking about ptarmigan or humans, and the human situation where we have a global increase in population of 2.5 people a second, that's birth rate minus death. That means tomorrow at this time there'll be 220,000 people more in the world. That's close to 250,000 more people. In 5 days, 1 million more people looking for all the goods and services that we expect out of life. And, you know, eventually we're going to be controlled. And we have a biological opportunity that other species don't. We have a brain that gives us forethought. We can reduce our birth rate and stabilize our populations that way. But if we don't, there is no doubt whatsoever that density-dependent mortality in various forms, starvation, disease, all these things that exert a greater pressure depending on the density of the population, eventually are going to reach up and stabilize our population. So we have to do something about populations. All the environmental efforts that are being made, including on climate change and so on, are just really grabbing the mop. They're necessary, but as long as the faucet is running of a human population growth rate as it is at the current time, we risk impairing the biosphere irreparably.
And do humans recognize that?
Not adequately. No, certainly not adequately. There have been some countries that have put population controls on, like China a few years ago, but basically we, society, doesn't address the issue of need to stabilize population. We go on with an edict that growth is good, and sometimes even you see this oxymoron of sustainable growth. Well, you know, that is an oxymoron. You can't sustain growth. So no, it's a very important underlying issue that needs far more attention in the world today.
It's not only just global populations of humans, it's also making a commitment, a global commitment, to save as much biodiversity as we can. Even today at 6 billion people, as John was saying, pretty soon that's going to be 9 to 12 billion by the turn of the century. But living sustainably within this earth that we have now, we really do have to do more than just putting the brakes on human populations. We have to also put the brakes on our out-of-control appetites that we've got right here, the consumption and the destruction of the world that we have. E.O. Wilson said that in order to forestall the next global extinction crisis, we had to save at least 10% of the land masses of this earth. That's excluding the oceans. When you consider that about 4 to 6% of the earth's surface is protected today, we've got national parks that do a very good job at doing this, but our provincial parks certainly don't. There's an awful lot of desecration that goes on in a lot of provincial parks. And we've just returned from a trip to Ecuador, and the living lungs of the earth down there, they've found oil under the rainforest, and they're in the Amazon, and they're considering mining that oil, getting that oil, extracting it, and cutting those trees. Surely, you know, as a thinking species with foresight and prudence, we have to look beyond our national boundaries and both the political and economic limitations that we've imposed upon ourselves to ensure the survival of this earth.
And do other species, these non-thinking species, do they do anything about, in terms of population, do they think about that as well, perhaps?
Well, they don't have the forethought, so
no, but
they just bump up against their carrying capacity, and either the populations collapse or a cycle or something like this happens. And we just have the unique opportunity to realize what we're doing.
No, an El Nino is going to be hitting Ecuador and the Galapagos, and the biologist we had traveling with us was saying that there's going to be all sorts of carnage there because the nutrients that upwell with the cold water are not going to be there, so the animals are going to starve. And the animals that we saw moving around and having their young flying in the skies, a lot of them are going to be dead. But they do bump up. But we as a thinking species, are we prepared to say, okay, this is fine for us? How many of us are going to survive the future?
Is there, you mentioned that you live in the Okanagan. Is there a place that you like being, both of you? Being out there in your travels?
Do you mean at home or in the world in general?
In the world in general. Like, is there a place that you both have been that you just love going to?
Well, there's so many places. We have a cabin back near Algonquin Park because we did so many years of research there. Back in the bush, it has no road to it, and we love being there. But the Okanagan, with all its rare species and grasslands, the shrub steppe ecosystem, we're so fortunate, and so fortunate in Canada because we have so much beauty, and we still have wild places, and we have a contribution to make to the world, and in terms of preserving our wilderness and our intact populations of wildlife, it's an important role we can play to the whole world internationally.
Well, you know, as wonderful as it has been for us, because we've worked on the masses of monarchs that were draping the Oyama firs in Mexico, and as marvelous as that all was, in a less dramatic way, it's just as stimulating. I know it kind of sounds like a Pollyanna statement, but to encounter the everyday life that goes along in the ponderosa pine grasslands that we live in. We see elk every now and then. We consider ourselves extremely fortunate when we see that. We see moose. Unfortunately, we don't see coyotes. They've been extirpated wolves. They've been extirpated in our areas.
Mm-hmm.
And coyotes have taken their place, but coyotes are very resilient, and we still get a lot of pleasure out of seeing them. But, you know, it's these various experiences that we have when we go out every day that it still pumps us up. The Okanagan is just a wonderful, wonderful place to be, and we're hoping that we can still accomplish having a national park in that area that will protect to a gold standard that wonderful shrub steppe ecosystem that we have.
How much of the year do you both spend traveling? Or outside of the Okanagan? Oh, some years none?
Yes.
But most years we're traveling some of the time.
We do research in Yellowstone, still on wolves. We're branched that out to doing wolf vocalization, and we've extended that now to the Mexican wolf in Arizona. But I guess, 90% of the time we're at home.
Yeah. And you've never had pets?
We have a dog.
Yeah. I keep reading in various books, and you mentioned it in yours as well. You see it a lot in environmental books. They talk about how powerful Rachel Carson's Silent Spring was to them.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about that in your book as being influential to the both of you. Is that a book that stands up? Like if I haven't read it, is it worth picking up now?
Oh, definitely. I really consider her my mentor. She's guided me through so much of my life.
Well, I guess part of the what she's stimulated is, what she said over and over is that an emotional connection and caring is the root to environmentalism, and that's really largely why we wrote the book. We felt that by explaining the science behind it, what's really going on in nature, then when you start to see that, the whole marvel of nature starts to really strike home. It's not just what species are there, but why and how they interact and what's happening in the ecosystem. When you start to realize that, then your respect level, your interest level, and your caring level, and your emotional connection all go up. And that's the springboard, if you care about something and you're emotionally connected, to being concerned and doing and taking whatever actions are necessary, if it's only in voting for environmentally responsible politicians, or all the other ways. There's lots of books on what you can do, but you know, we've been regaled with environmental horror stories for decades, and we haven't gone on and on in that in our book. The facts are all out there. It's as if facts don't motivate us anymore. We're almost immune to them, and that's why we felt that we wanted to try to create a greater emotional connection. That really goes back to what Rachel Carson tried to do, too.
And it's really important to get this emotional connection with children, too. Children have a natural affinity for nature, and unfortunately, they're being disengaged today more and more than ever before. If you take any child out to a pond or to a lake or a seashore, a river, and they can see a frog or a duck, lift up a rock and see a salamander or a worm, the result is just glee, the sheer delight. Children are going through what Richard Louv calls nature deficit disorder. If we want healthy, well-rounded kids, we need to make sure that they spend time out of doors in natural settings where they're free to imagine and problem solve and discover and dream. These children just have to get their hands into the mud and experience all that's out there.
Mary, John, this is such a thoughtful, stimulating, and important book. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Joseph.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Ptarmigan's Dilemma, an exploration into how life organizes and supports itself. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. Its authors, John and Mary Thiberge, on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.